We're deeply thankful to the Lord for another opportunity to meet together in the worship of our Lord and Savior. And we're thankful to the Lord that we have the religious liberties and freedoms together. And I think all of us ought to be thankful to the Lord that we still have the physical strength and ability to gather together in the house of God, although based on some of the things I see out here, some of you have had to come here with apparatus and great difficulty, but you're still here. And after I was beaten up by a cow, about a 1,000-pound Brangus cow, in December 6, 2006, there was a time when I went back to the pulpit of my home church, leaning on a pole a little bit of the time. I had to use a cane. And I learned to be very, very sympathetic for people that I've noticed all over the years came onto the house of God with their apparatus. So we appreciate several of you here. Are here this morning, perhaps, sort of waging a battle against the flesh. And we come to some understanding of what the Lord had to say when he said, "The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." So we're remind you that as long as we still have the liberties, the freedom to do so, and I cannot guarantee that we always will, we should avail ourselves of every opportunity to be in the house of God. So we deeply appreciate the prayer your pastors offered. I also deeply appreciate a couple other things. In most places over the United States where it's announced, for instance, that I'm supposed to start speaking at 11, which is done most over the country, but sort of like practice in Middle Georgia that I experienced first time I was ever in this country in 1968. I rather like it, but I've sort of got to remind myself. supposed to start this morning at 11, so I'll try to remind myself maybe at 12. I haven't been up here an hour, but be that as it may, in most places across the United States, if on a Sunday it's given out, I'm supposed to start at 11. Usually by the time we have their introductions and other things like that, it's about 11:15 or 11:20. And so if I preach till 12:05, I preached an hour and 5 minutes, which in fact I did not, if you can keep track of such things. And your pastor's been in demand enough. He knows what I'm talking about. In most places over the country, if it's given out on a night appointment, I'm supposed to start speaking at 8. Usually when you have the introductions and the various other things our brethren engage in, many of these places I start speaking at 8:15 or 8:20. And so if I go till 9:05, I preach an hour and 5 minutes. Sometimes I've given credit for doing a lot of things you really don't deserve the credit, or you may say blame. Also, at the time your pastor was praying that the Lord might relieve my mind of every burden and all this type of thing, I turned off my abominable cell phone, and I hope you've turned off yours. But in turning off my abominable cell phone, about the same time your pastor was praying I'd be relieved of burdens, a burden came upon me. my wife really likes when I'm away from home like this to call her about three times a day at least on the cell phone, quick calls, let her find out they're all right, Sarah and Danny, and let her know I'm all right. As I turned off that abominable cell phone, it reminded me, and kind of moving around this morning, I haven't called my wife yet. If I had good sense, I'd ask you to sing another song. I'd step out there and put in a quick call if I had good sense. But you say, well, that would greatly aggravate us. Yes, but see, I have a choice in aggravating you, all you folk, or aggravating her. And if I had any sense, that's a very easy choice to make. I'll be leaving you folk, remember? I've got to go home and face little blue eyes. So a choice between aggravating all of you folk and aggravating her, that's really no choice at all if I had any sense, but I'll proceed in... So I'll try to make it up to her later and incur, I suppose if I have incurred her wrath, I will get over it. I've been getting over it about 55 years and some odd months, so indeed I shall survive, but I ask her, sense her interest, your prayers. Once again, if I follow the impressions of my mind, and that's the only way I know how to preach, I'll begin by saying that and this year, there's some things have sort of recycled and come back around in my mind that I'd not really had on my mind for many, many years. So, which is by way of telling you that for many, many years I have considered Genesis 9, 10, and 11 three of the most fascinating chapters of the Bible. They were on my mind quite a bit 40 years ago. Really not had much burden to speak on them, probably for at least that long. But this year, sort of, my mind's been centered around these three chapters. I'll very quickly tell you why they're very fascinating, some of the most fascinating, interesting chapters of the Bible. Genesis chapters 9, 10, and 11 considers the early days of this world immediately after the flood. And in Genesis chapter 9, we're told about how that in Genesis chapter that God divided the nations and the peoples and the races and the kingdoms here, and that we all came from three sources, the sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. We come over to Genesis chapter 10, and we have what's known as the Table of Nations. Here's the old Bible names of the descendants of Shem, descendants of Ham, descendants of Japheth. And it'd probably take a long time, be very tedious, if I were to try to go through that table of nations, take a lot of these old Bible names and tell you the modern names of those nations, but that's very fascinating. Just to give you for one quick example, we find among the descendants of Japheth one named Javan, but this corresponds to the Greeks. The Greeks teach their own people and have for centuries that their ancestors were the people of Javan. That's just one example. We come over here in Genesis chapter 10, and we find a place there where God divided this world into continents. That's quite a fascinating subject within itself. But we come to Genesis chapter 11, and we are told there in verse 1 that the whole earth was of one speech and one language. We're now coming to what you folk here, you Bible readers, will recognize as something that took place out on the plains of Shinar, where back in the days when the earth was all of one speech and one language, these folk here set out to build a tower. You recognize I'm in the area where we read about the Tower of Babel. So we have here the dividing of the earth into one speech and one language. And I suppose if I had three more opportunities to preach here, and I don't, and if I were a systematic, organized preacher, I'd probably preach this morning on Genesis 9, maybe take up Genesis 10 later, and then I'll go to Genesis 11. But since I sometimes do things backwards, and the burden of my mind this morning is on Genesis 11. We come to this place where the earth was one speech and one language. And I think most of you folk are aware. You may not be as aware of it down here in middle Georgia, but you become very well aware of it in places like Atlanta, Dallas, Memphis, and many parts of the United States. But we're vastly becoming a multi-ethnic, multi-racial, so-called multicultural nation here in the United States of America. Quite frequently in airports where there are more people around me not speaking English than are. So sometimes when I'm around folk, a lot of them, sometimes more of them not speaking English than are, I think about God dividing the speeches and languages of this earth, and all I could say in my mind, did a great job of it, Lord, thou doest well, exactly what I expected. So we come here to Genesis chapter 11. Despite that God has already divided them into races and tribes and nations of people, at this particular time, they still have one speech and one language. Well, we're going to notice in Genesis chapter 11 that these people over here are not using this unity to the glory of God. The fact that they are still of all one speech and one language. Bible tells us that they go out on the plain of Shinar, and their goal is to build a high tower. But the purpose of it is not to honor and glorify God. It's let us make us a name. It could also be that these people, the flood, of course, is a much fresher event to them than it would be of us today. That's the understatement of the morning. Whether these people here, these people here, of course, did not experience the flood. There's only 8 people experienced the flood, remember. But they're not over, say, a generation or so removed. And so it's been handed down, a rather fresh event, on people's minds. Whether these people decide they're going to build this high tower, as some have suggested, that if another flood ever hits us, that we'll have a place of refuge. This isn't going to happen to us again. That's the idea some people have on it. Bible's not really clear on that. I don't really have a problem with it, but I won't deal in speculation on that. But God knew their motives. Lord found this offensive. Lord knew a lot more about their motives. Well, he knew all about their motives and the intents of their hearts, knew all about that. He's told us in the Bible what I need to know. Bible says that they're all one speech, one language. Here we have the original UN, United Nuts. And they're all one speech, one language. And they set out to build a tower. And they said that this tower may reach unto heaven. That expression there, reach unto heaven, is a Hebrew figure of speech. Hebrew language is filled with figures of speech. Some languages are not. In some languages, people say precisely what they mean. Hebrew is filled with figures of speech, and I'll probably come back to that later. Go over to Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 28, and God's self-defining Bible will tell you what that expression unto heaven would mean. Over in Deuteronomy chapter 1, this is the time, you remember, that they send out the 12 spies to spy out the land of Canaan, one out of each tribe. Those spies came back, and 10 out of the 12 bring back a discouraging report. Despite the fact God delivered them across the Red Sea, God had promised, did all kinds of miracles. God had showed them miracle after miracle, and God's told them that you're going into that land. I'm going to give you that land. There were apparently 10 out of 12 of them had forgotten the promises of God, and you're going to find that they came back and discouraged the people. There were 10 out of 12 came back with a report like this. The people over there in Canaan are greater and taller than we, and their cities over there are walled up unto heaven. They didn't say that those cities are walled up all the way to the throne of God in heaven. That was a Hebrew figure of speech to indicate they're very high. They're walled unto heaven. So God's self-defining Bible, just comparing Scripture with Scripture, will give us a definition of what walled unto heaven means. I have no idea that these people over here intended to build a tower that reach all the way to God's throne in heaven. I don't have that idea at all. But they intended to build a very, very high tower. Purpose of it was to let us make us a name. We find that God is not pleased with this, and God says, let us go down and confound their language. That expression there, let us, ought to teach any reasonable person that there's more than one Godhead. If you never read a Bible before, and you start in the book of Genesis, you'd learn that if you pay half attention to the Bible. You remember God in the creation said, let us make man in our image and our likeness. That reveals something, or indicates something, made very clear later in the Bible. More than one in the Godhead. Three, yet one. Three in unity. That number one can mean one in number, or it can mean one in unity. So that's another sermon within itself. I've got to stay try to stay at the main thing I'm talking about, despite the fact hallways of truth open up right and left, but sometimes I've got to slam them. I've said many times, I have clear memories of my early days of preaching in South Central Mississippi, and there were a lot of old folks told me about back in the days when folk there didn't mix like they do today. There were a lot of white folk over there told me that from time to time they would go over around the woods around Meridian, Mississippi. There was a very able black preacher over there. He's the able white folk right to hear him. And sometime that very outstanding black preacher would be up preaching on something, and while he'd preach, it open up another hallway of truth. He'd look and say, "Oh, that bring on heap more preaching. Ain't got time to do it now." Okay, real big sermon in that number one. Sometimes that word one in the Bible, and like we use it in everyday life, means one in number. But sometimes it means one in unity. My wife and I have been married over 55 years. According to the Bible, we're supposed to be of one flesh. But I don't think they'd buy it down at the airport if she ever flew anywhere it be, which that'd be a rare event. And I went up there with one ticket or one boarding pass. I say to her, "Where's hers?" And I said, "We've been married 55 years. We're one flesh." I don't think she'd get by on my boarding pass. It's obvious when it says that these two should be one. That means one in unity, not one in number. But that's quite a subject. Got to slam that one. Heap more preaching. Can't do it now. We come here. God says, "Let us go down and confound their language." God goes down and confounds their languages where they can't even talk to each other. And then it says they were scattered abroad over the face of the earth. When you begin to study the vast differences of languages, even among people live close to each other. Here's groups of people that maybe there's only a river separating them, but they're geographically very close together. Over here you find a language that's very, very different to this one right here. And I'm going to give you some examples of them in a minute. I have read quite a few books in my life, being a lifetime readaholic and a lifetime information addict. I've read quite a few books by evolutionists, and some of these folk tend to be honest about some things. Some of these folks have said that this vast multiplicity and this great difference in the languages on this earth presents a problem to them. Some of them are willing to grant that they do have problems, that they don't have it all solved. One of my favorite quotes comes from a famous one named Huxley way back in the past. There were actually two of those Huxleys, but anyway, the Huxleys back there, great supporters of Charles Darwin and all that bunch, but one of those Huxleys made this statement. He said, "We grant that there are difficulties in the theory of evolution. There are questions we cannot answer. But," he said, "the only other alternative, special creation, is totally unacceptable." That sounds very open-minded now, doesn't it? We grant that there's problems with this. We don't have it all figured out. But the only other choice is special creation. That's totally unacceptable. That'll remind some of you Bible readers of Romans chapter 1. We'll begin at verse 20. We find where the Apostle Paul writes over here, "The invisible things of him from the creation of the world," meaning the invisible things of God from the creation of the world, "are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they're without excuse." That just says if we start studying the things that are made out here, all the way from this endless, boundless universe, the big things, and then we go the other way and we start studying small things, and we come down to molecules, and then we start studying atoms, then we start studying the itty-bitty parts of the atoms, and on the take another example, we start studying human reproductive cells, or life cells, and folk are sometimes amazed at the knowledge that can be stored in computers. There's more information in one of your reproductive cells than you could possibly put in a computer. There's information in there about your ancestors all the way back to Adam. But when we come out, start studying tiny things, which could only be studied with very powerful, not ordinary microscopes, but electron microscopes and things beyond that, when we start studying very small things, like human reproductive cells, we find that these small things, they have smaller parts. Now all of a sudden we're dealing with the genes and chromosomes, but we find they have smaller parts. Now we're dealing with RNA and DNA, and we come down to what we might assume is the smallest part, but develop a more powerful microscope, and you're going to find that the small parts always have smaller parts. I remember several years ago, I cut out some newspaper clippings and added them to my massive and ever-growing doomsday file. And there's folk over the country know I'm interested in things, so people constantly sending me clippings and information they pick up. But about several years ago, some of these folks study all this. They said in studying mitochondria, they had come to the conclusion that all females on this earth have a common ancestor. Well, glory hallelujah, I could tell them her name. I knew her name when I was 6 years old. Name is Eve, by the way. I think you caught that hint. A few years back, I've got these clippings I could show you. They've come to the conclusion all females on this earth have a common ancestor. People talk about the Bible being archaic, out of date, and all that. Well, they've had to run fast as they could all these years just to catch up with it. Isn't this wonderful? Now, so, one way, but anyway, okay, Romans 1, verse 20. I was quoting Mr. Huxley, who said, we don't have it all solved. It's not perfect, a lot we can't answer, but the only alternative, special creation, is totally unacceptable. Back to Romans chapter 1, verse 20. He goes on to tell you that if we start studying what God's made all the way down to the big things, to the tiny, itty-bitty-bitty things, it's very evident that God is and God runs things. But he goes on to say, and there's a lot else here in Romans chapter 1 I'll leave up to you to read. He says over here, professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and he says, because they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. Listen to that very carefully. The Apostle Paul did not say, because the abundance of evidence begins to show there is no God. He didn't say that. He said, because they did not like to retain God in their knowledge. You know why they didn't like to retain God in their knowledge? Because the idea that there's a sovereign God up there who's watching everything I do, who has standards by which he expects me to live and might someday judge me for violating those standards, gets in the way of this adulterous, fornicating, perverted, drunken lifestyle that I've chosen to live. In other words, it cramps my style. You catching it? People today use a lot of nice words. I read time and time again, hear over and over, that we have a very permissive society today. Oh, that word permissive is so cute. Actually, it's an adulterous, fornicating, perverted lifestyle. Caught it? That's not quite so nice, is it? All right. So we have here some giants out here in the world. Giants in the world of evolutionists. Just told us that the main problem we have is special creation. We don't like it. It's unacceptable. The Apostle Paul put it in his own language. They did not like to retain God in their knowledge. But some of them have granted that one of the greatest problems they have that they haven't solved yet is the very thing I'm setting before you. How in the world, through our evolutionary process, are we going to be able to work out that folk over here like evolving and working up, that their languages became so divided? There's a super brain friend of mine over in Birmingham. I was in a bit of conversation with him about this last summer. He gave me pulled some papers off the internet and handed them to me. And here you have folk that are not looking at this from a Bible standpoint. Understand? They're not looking at this from a Bible standpoint. It's just their research. And folk who've tried to figure out the origin of languages, not from a Bible standpoint, I said the third time, or a biblical standpoint, many of them came to the conclusion that all the languages on this earth originated in what some of them called Anatolia, or maybe Turkey. Well. Back several years ago, there were folks set out to find the Ark. I read quite a few books from them. They'd heard word-of-mouth legends from people up in the high, high mountains of Turkey that there was a wooden vessel, you know, that some of it seen in the ice. I know your dad, I discussed this Brother Connolly's father years ago. He probably read the books. I was tuned into it way back then. And no doubt might have passed the books on, discussed it with you. There were people who even went, Bible tells us the ark landed on Mount Ararat. And those high mountains probably up toward Turkey, there were folk, sincere folk, following reports that people been passing down from generation to generation. There's shifting ice and all these kind of problems, but there were some folk reported images of a wooden vessel seen in the ice up there. There were some folks set out to find it. And last I heard about this, this helps know some geography here. Turkey borders southern part of Russia, or what used to be called the Soviet Union, and the Russians very paranoid about people going way up into those high elevations, and perhaps they were doing that for spying on bases they have in Georgia, not meaning, you know, Georgia, but Russian Georgia, such as that. I haven't had any information on this in years. But as I understand the Bible, Bible's clear where Noah's Ark landed, and here where they began to divide after the flood. And so now we have folk over here researching, not based on the Bible. They came coming to the conclusion that the languages we have on earth today, that their roots, according to them, were probably close enough for government work to where the Bible says. Well, maybe they'll catch up some of these days, pray for them, have patience with them, sincerely doubt it. Now, as we look at this, which is a problem, to admitted problem to a lot of evolutionists who don't see the intervening hand of Almighty God, here's some of the problems they deal with. That among some of the most backward, ignorant, uncivilized people they've ever found on the face of the earth, I'm talking about some of the most backward people in Africa and elsewhere, among some of the most backward, uncivilized people on earth, they find these people speaking languages that are actually more complicated than some of us more advanced, more civilized people speak. Some of these languages are called inflective languages. That just means here's one word. Meaning of that word can mean several things just on how you inflect it. Some of these so-called backward languages, when it comes to things such as gender, tense, case, inflection, far more complicated than the languages of some of us folks are supposed to be more evolved and more developed. This has been a problem to them. I've already given another problem. Some places on this earth you find people, maybe just a river between them. Languages greatly different. All right, let's just take a quick trip through Europe. Let's suppose we begin in French. I've studied quite a few languages not going to the depth of some people who teach them, but I've had interest in many, many languages. I found a few languages. I don't think it'd be too hard for me to learn more about them. One of them is Spanish, to be a relatively easy language to learn, and might be a good language for everybody in the United States start learning, but of course Brother Philip being from, Dad being originally from Texas, and say I thought his dad's from California. No, he's a Texan, went out there to do foreign missionary work among the heathen, but be it as it may, I consider your pastor a Texan. You're welcome, sir. Welcome, sir. Be that as it may, most people in the Southwest, you know, have some familiarity with Spanish, or used to be called Tex-Mex. I found out later that I'm talking about folk in our country might speak Spanish a while, mix a little English in it. We called it Tex-Mex. I found out that's gone out of style. It's now called Spanglish. I never thought Spanish would be too hard to learn. My daughter, David Lindberg, was proficient in it, so was my son-in-law, Dan, etc. Always had sort of a natural ability to pick up German words and such as that. From my dealings with French, I don't think French would be a very easy language for me. Sometimes traveling, my wife and Danny and I traveling across Louisiana, heading over to Mississippi toward where Brother David and the grandchildren are, and meetings to preach and all that. My wife would go along, she'd say, "How do you pronounce the name of that?" I'd tell her, Parish. So why are they called parishes? I said, "That's a hangover from the French influence in Louisiana." "Well, what's the name of that one?" I say, "Robichaud." "What do you call that one?" "Devereaux." "Do you have any idea how those are spelled?" I don't want to say too much about French. I don't think that'd be the very easiest language for me to spell. I'll tell you a story about a high-class French lady down around New Orleans. She has a dog, and I'll just go ahead and tell you. She goes over here to this cabinet maker carpenter and said, "I want you to build a doghouse for my dog, Fido." She has a diagram, very elaborate doghouse. He said, "Yes, ma'am, I believe I can build that." "Well, my Fido is not an ordinary dog. My Fido has got to have a very, very special house." And said, "When you get through building this house for my Fido," said, "I want you to put his name right over it." Cabinet maker man called her back. She comes in, looks over the elaborate doghouse. She said, "I'm very, very pleased with the doghouse. You built it exactly to my specifications. However, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to insist that you paint over Fido's name and spell Fido's name correctly." Well, the poor cabinet maker just put over the door, F-I-D-O, Fido. She said, "Oh, no, no, no. My Fido, that's spelled P-H-Y-D-E-A-U-X, Fido." So that's a little hint as to why I don't think French would be one of my favorite languages or the easiest ones to pick up. To be Fido ought to be F-I-D-O. Okay, now, so we're in France. You got a certain type of people, got a certain type of language. You come to the Rhine River, you go over and you're going into Germany. Man, you have got a different language altogether. Also got a different type of people altogether. Man, over in Germany, you start dealing with a language of multi-syllable words. You start having to deal with words like Gerstenschlager. I'll give you a lot more examples. Something over here we might say in two or three syllables. Some of the German words can seem like they got about 16 syllables. Gerstenschlager is one of the easiest ones. I won't bother you some of the hard ones. Totally different people, totally different language, just a river in between them. Now, we're not done. We keep traveling across Germany. We get over into Poland, Czechoslovakia. You come over here, start dealing with the Slavic family of languages.
Oh, man.
Now, do you ever have a job?
Yes, you have got a job. So, keep on moving, you get over into Russia.
Now, you have got a job. My son's made four trips every 2 years, 2006, 2008, 2010, 2012, to preach to some people. I say Siberia. A lot of folks, when you say Russia, they think about Moscow, you know, European Russia. When my son lands in Moscow, he's still got to fly 2,600 miles to Irkutsk, Siberia. The 2,600 miles is a greater distance than the distance across the United States from New York to, say, Sacramento, California. What you call Russia is a whopping big place. If you want to get some idea where my son goes, or has gone four times to preach to people, look at the your globe or map of the world, go over to China. Right north of China, you're going to see Mongolia. Right above Mongolia, over in Russia or Siberia, you're going to see a huge lake, Lake Baikal. City there, and my son says, Americans could never learn to pronounce that like a Russian. But Irkutsk, close enough. Might ought to spell it. Some of you want to get on your search engine and look it up. I-R-K-U-T-S-K. You say, well, how in the world your son ever wind up preaching to folk in Russia? That's a very interesting story. I'll compress it. There were some Russian Free Grace preachers. Began to read the Bible on their own. And I'd love to tell you a wonderful story about once upon a time their ancestors, going way back there, were Free Grace people, believed just about like Primitive Baptists did. In the Communist Revolution, 1917, when the Communists took over Russia, they took out of the pulpit, shot and killed those Free Grace preachers. They put preachers of the Russian Baptist Federation in the pulpit that would preach the government line. Things loosened up a bit, you know, with the so-called breakup of the Soviet Union. And some of these preachers of the Russian Baptist Federation, instead of the Bible on their own, and coming to the doctrine of what they call free grace, very much like Primitive Baptists, actually found out they were going back to their ancient roots. Their ancestors long ago had been Free Grace Baptists, much like us. So, back about 2005, they began to search the internet to find if there was anybody on earth believed like they believed. And searching the internet, they came across my son's website. So, I could tell you some more things. I'm not trying to glorify myself. I'm just trying to glorify the Lord. When I was preaching in Atlanta last November on Friday night, Elder Harder got up and mentioned something didn't really know. He told when he was in the Philippines, there's a group of people from China came to visit him. They had been reading and studying on their own. They began to search the worldwide internet, see if there's anybody like them. Said, we came across several preachers. Said, the one we could understand the best is the Elder Sonny Piles. You ever hear of him? Old Brother Gus said, oh, yes, I know him. Well, I didn't do this. I'm not into these things, but I found out a few years back there were brethren had the high technology at the time. And 3 years ago, they told me they'd put over 2,100 sermons of mine, radio master sermons going way back, over 2,100 of them on the worldwide internet. I didn't mind. That's just fine. They put a lot of them on their sense. I have heard from other people in other parts of the world that download those sermons. All right. Here we have people from China making inquiries. I could add other places. I want to throw this in right fast. There's other groups of people in the United States might talk about, you know, they spread what they believe here, and they spread what they believe there, and they spread what they believe there. But I've studied lots and lots of world history. There's lots of places on this earth.
especially Central and South America and others I could name, where the Spanish soldiers went in with their muskets and swords. Behind them came the Jesuits and Roman missionaries. There are other places I could name on this earth where the British army went in there with their muskets and swords. India, for example. Give you many more. Behind the British army came their so-called missionaries. Are you getting the picture? In these places, those people spreading what they call the gospel were not invited in. The army, the military of their nations went in first. These people trying to convert other people went in behind them. As far as I know right now, every place that primitive Baptists have been, and I could name you several, every place primitive Baptists have been, they were invited in. I don't know of an exception to that. Since Brother Sam Bryant used to pastor this church, you no doubt been aware about Brother Obey. You may know some of the background about him. But this is the link that started a lot of our brethren going into Africa. I've done told you what opened the door. My son making 4 trips to Siberia. And, of course, the word has spread to other parts of these preachers and people notifying people in other parts of Russia, like the Ukraine and such as this. I won't try to labor this point, but be sure I can document what I'm saying. Places for old Baptists to be, we've been asking. We've had a Macedonian call. If you know what I'm talking about, the 16th chapter of Acts. The Apostle Paul has a mind to go a certain direction with the gospel, but in a vision in the night, this man in Macedonia says, come over and help us. So, to move on to this story. Back in the times my son was in Russia, 4 times, getting well acquainted with the Russian people. They told him that their very complicated Russian alphabet. You ever look at it and study seriously? It's a hodgepodge of Greek letters. Some of them turned around backwards. Sort of a hodgepodge of Greek letters turned around backwards and made up letters and all this. And according to them, it was put together hundreds of years ago by a drunken priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. That's what the Russians say about it. Now, but we're not through. I believe I'll just begin this way. Several years back, I was staying with Elder E.W. Hoover and his wife Linda, two of my longtime friends, two of my best friends, and there was a morning they had some things to tend to in a Lowe's store. L-O-W-E-S. Y'all have them in Georgia? I've been in Georgia a lot, but about all I know about Georgia is primitive Baptist churches and, you know, the places between them. Okay. I don't know enough about Georgia. A lot of sightseeing to do in Georgia, I'm sure. I just never have done it. I come to Georgia to preach. I get my preaching done and go home. Maybe some sightseeing preachers, if they come, you royally entertain them. Okay. Now, when I had to go on to Lowe's, big box store, much like Home Depot. Surely you have those. Okay, while they were in there tending their business, I began to wander around, walking, getting exercise, such as this. Went by a service counter. And I'm not going to say these are in every Lowe's store. That part of North Carolina is known for being a really mixed up place. Multicultural, a mix of all kinds of people. So over here at the service counter was a thing over here with a long list of plastic things about this wide, and you could flip them on rings. Up at the top in English it says, in what language can you read this? Or in what language are you reading this? Now, I don't even imagine that they had people there
that were able to translate all these languages that followed. I can't imagine that. I suspect if a Korean or somebody else came up there, that they'd probably have to do it through a computer electronic translating device. Maybe you know more about this than I do. And look at those cards you can flip. I thought, let me see how long I can play this game. Of course, written up here at the top in English, in what language are you reading this? Here you have the same thing written below, and then down in the ultra fine print, where you have to squint your eyes, it tells you what language it is. Well, right beneath that is written in Spanish. That same question, written in Spanish. That's Spanish. Just squint my eyes, it is Spanish. Move on down. Same sentence here, written in German. I could make out 75% of it, but it had enough of German ring, it's not hard to pick up. Move on down. Written in French. Of course, I've done told you I couldn't read French, but it had enough French ring to it, and enough of those E-A-U-X's on the end of it. I said, that's got to be French. Fine print, it's French. So, I'm not going to try to pretend that I could read it on down in all the languages that I followed, but I could play the game for a while. That's why I had to get out of the game. These languages I mentioned so far, you know, French, German, Spanish, move on down some others. Languages are different, but they're still using our same alphabet. I mean, like A, B, C, D, E, F, you know, using our same alphabet. That's why I had to get out of the game. Here's this question over here, written in what appears to be hand scratch. Okay, written in hand scratch. First of all, we have Chinese. Written in what appears to you a different kind of hand scratch. Japanese, they're not the same. Another different kind of hand scratch. Korean. Move on down, we have some flowing language like this. Arabic. Move on down, some other language like this. Hebrew. Okay, what I'm dealing with here. God not only mixed up the languages of this earth so. way they say things. He confounded it in the way they write things. They don't use the same alphabet. In fact, a lot of them don't use what's properly an alphabet. I've had a lot of dealings with Chinese people in the last few years, lots and lots of dealings with Chinese people, and sort of had a fascination with the Chinese way of writing, and if you around a Chinese person and you refer to their way of writing as an alphabet, they're probably too kind and polite to correct you, but actually it is not an alphabet. With an alphabet, we take these letters and build words. I can take C-A-T and build cat. I can take C-A-T, build act. You know, move around. I can take D-O-G and build God, a dog. I can mix it around, build God. That's what you do with an alphabet. Building blocks, mix them around. That Chinese way of writing is not an alphabet. It is a collection of characters in which there's a picture. And at the present time, there's close to 1,000 of them. My 1979 encyclopedia says that back then 700, but I'm told the Chinese people are today close to 1,000. You say, well, why that difference? Have you ever thought about how many words we have had to add or build just because of computer technology and all that? You ever thought of that? I can start naming you a whole bunch of words that are not in my wife's 1955 collegiate dictionary. No, they're not. I can name you a lot of words not in my daughter-in-law's 1983 dictionary. They're not. All kinds of words and terms we're having to build to express new concepts because of computer technology, all this. I could give you a few examples, but you're thinking, people. All right, now, the Chinese over here, getting into high tech and all this, when they have to express new concepts, they just have to add characters. Now, I've been sort of made a hobby, sideline study of the Chinese collection of characters. I can identify several dozen of them. We come over one of the Chinese characters for trouble. They have several, you know, calamity trouble. One of those Chinese characters for trouble, they draw a roof, and they draw two women under it. Oh, two women under one roof, trouble. Sure made trouble for a lot of men in the Bible, remember? Remember Sarah and Hagar? Huh? Remember Rachel and Leah and the handmaids? Remember? Maybe exceptions. Might be exceptions. But exceptions don't disprove rules. The very fact that this is an exception proves that the other is the rule. Bible says, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, the race is not always to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. But Mr. Winston Churchill added to that verse, but that's the way to bet. Yes, Winnie the Pooh, that's the way to bet. The race usually goes to the strong, swift, but the fastest horses stumble. Fastest runners develop shin splints and spasms and have to hit the ground. Race is usually to the swift. Battle usually goes to the strong. I grant there are exceptions in life, but you better follow rules. Okay. Megan, you may name a case where daughter-in-law, mother-in-law get along fine. Okay, fine. You may be able to name me some places where two women under one roof works just well. Okay, fine, fine, fine. But Chinese have observed that two women under one roof. Okay, now, I got to mention something right quickly, that a place in life where the old blind hog rooted up an acorn. back last April, I was early born in conversation with David's wife, Karen. And she'd done a wonderful job of homeschooling their two children. One of them, grandson, 16. Allison passed 14. She'd done a super, super job. Sometimes I'm in her den, and they're having their school, and I can sort of overhear what's going on. She's teaching them Latin, all kinds of things, a lot of super brain stuff, doing a wonderful job of it. In this early morning discussion I was having with her back last April, she was telling me about the period in, you know, world history, human development that they're dealing with. And I mentioned to her, I said, I sort of gritted my teeth several years ago and said, I've got too many books already. I'm just not buying any more books. But that doesn't stop them coming in. There are a lot of people who listen to my recordings, whatever. People who hear me preach think I need enlightenment. So I do, of course. And I'm giving books. People send them to me and get a lot of them for free. But I told my daughter-in-law, I said, I passed it. I just made it. Not buying any more books. Reached a point in life I need to be getting rid of them. But I said, had opportunity to receive the flyer, sort of some of this propaganda, on a book. They're supposed to show that there's a lot of things in the Chinese collection of characters today that have a relationship to the ancient Hebrew and the world after the flood. I said, I passed opportunity to buy that book. and I've somewhat regretted.
Light came on. She said, "Oh, you remind me of something that the children studied a while back." She goes over and gets a book. And in this book, they're showing that when we go back and study this Chinese collection of characters, also some of the tapestry work of the Persians and many of these people, when you start studying these things from a viewpoint of a Bible believer, now I'm telling you, I want to illustrate something just in a minute. One of those Chinese pictures. And I'm quite sure Chinese have been drawing, they've been drawing this off, don't tell them how many times, and didn't know what they were drawing. Because they're not looking at this like I'm looking at it from the Bible viewpoint. I started reading this book, and here's the explanation and some very thing I want to get into in just a few seconds. Then they have pictures in there, Persian, ancient Persian tapestry work, pottery work, and all that. And then there are symbols and things that if you're viewing this from the viewpoint of a Bible believer, shows plenty of evidence that when God divided the nations, you know, the sons of Adam, they went their separate ways. And they were divided, especially, we're talking about over here in Genesis 11, that they carried away memories, or at least word-of-mouth memories. They carried away things, in which we can see that there was a worldwide flood, a lot of other things. Try to illustrate what I'm talking about. Next morning, my daughter-in-law told a super brain that David's pastored for years, that how carried away that all was about this book I was reading. This super brain forwards something over there. My Karen picks up on her laptop and said, "If you've got time to look at this, I hope you'll look at this film." Well, I had John outside and Danny outside, and they're breathing that they wanting to me go do something with them, of course. But I sat down here and I began to watch one of the most fascinating things I've ever watched in my life. And I made agreement with Karen that next time I go back, I'm going to study and watch it again at least two or three times. In Hong Kong, and a lot of you folk know, for many years, Hong Kong was ruled by the British. In Hong Kong, there were several thousand people gathered together out here. On the stage is a very brilliant Chinese man. Very brilliant. Of course, a lot of these people here in Hong Kong, because of that British influence, speak English. But standing right beside him is a cute little Chinese lady, and he talks so long, then she explains the sepulchre here in the Chinese language. Oh, by the way, I mentioned a while ago, here you have German language of multi syllable words. Chinese is a language of one syllable words. Hong Kong, Kung Fu, Shanghai. You want to go on? Beijing, which means northern capital. Chinese, language of one syllable words. Greatly different from German, many other languages. Okay, she's giving this in Chinese. He's giving it in English. I thought about this later. Of course, one reason they're doing it, a lot of people like to understand English, but they've got another intent I can see. They intend that this a video or film be distributed throughout the English-speaking world. This super brilliant Chinese, and he ought to know what he's talking about, because he's talking to a bunch of Chinese in Hong Kong, and I'm sure if he didn't know what he's talking about, somebody would come up and easily bluff him. He says, he draws a long arc over here, arc like this. He says the Chinese have the longest written record of their history of any people on earth other than the Hebrews or the Jews. You hear what I'm saying? With many peoples on this earth, it's word of mouth, it's legendary, just passed down. But as far as having a written record of their history, Chinese have the longest written record of their history of any people on earth other than the Jews or the Hebrews. You know why the Hebrews have the longest? They've got the Old Testament. That's how far their written record. Jewish Old Testament. How far does it go back? Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Okay. This superintendent Chinese man. So the Chinese have a written record of their history that goes farther back than any people on earth other than the Hebrews. Chinese to Hebrews. He said, we have a written record where we can prove our history going back over 2,500 years. Draws this arc. Then, he brings up the religions that have been most dominant in China in what we call recent centuries. He said that we have Confucius, you know, daddy of Confucianism. But Confucius only goes back about 500-600 years. We have Taoism, which the Chinese T is pronounced like a D. They call it Taoism. And in your things you're going to look up, it's going to be spelled T-A-O-I-S-M, but he's got a spell like Chinese pronounce it, D-A-O. I first learned this. A great Chinese acupuncture doctor helped me greatly. His name is Tao. He said, well, in China, I'm called Tao. Okay. So we have Buddhism. Buddha doesn't go back all that far. Tao, or Tao, should go, doesn't go back all that far. Confucius does go back all that far. I'm talking about, you know, 500-600 years, long and none. He said what that the Chinese people believed during this long period of which we have a record. What they believed during this long period before Tao, Buddha, and Confucius, what did they believe? He said they believed in a god they call Shanti, or Shandi. Okay, he begins to describe Shanti or Shandi. Shanti or Shanti means the Most High God. Is that ringing any bells? The Most High God. You know what this sounds like? Doesn't sound to me like a polytheistic people with a whole shelf of gods like they have in India. Sounds monotheistic to me. One God. His name means the Most High God. Well, that ought to be ringing some bells in the ears of you Bible readers. Let's go way back to Genesis 14:15. Start reading about Melchizedek. Remember him? He is the priest of the Most High God. This brilliant Chinese person goes to describing Shanti. Oh, you know what Shanti sounds like to me and what sounds like to you? Sounds like the God of the Old Testament that revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Am I making this halfway clear? Then this Chinese person, man I'm talking about, begins to draw off the very thing I had read about in my grandchildren or my daughter-in-law's book. He begins to point out that in this Chinese collection of pictures, there's all kinds of evidences that take us right back to the Old Testament, world of the flood. Now, grant that Chinese, you see, if I make this halfway clear, for hundreds and hundreds of years, the Chinese people, when they left right after the flood, and after this division into the language, and they headed eastward, they were on the right track.
They still believed in the Most High God. They still believed in the flood. They were on the right track. It was later that they were brought under the influences of these other religions I've named. Okay, on right fast. He said, for instance, in the Chinese language alphabet, it's not alphabet, Kachi. You got that? No, collection of characters. Said, in our Chinese picture writing, one of the ways we express a big boat, and I'll just have to draw this there. I could draw it for you on paper. He says, makes a mark sort of this way. Said, this means vessel, in a sense of a boat. This. Then he makes a figure inside it. This is, of course, Chinese for eight. Got it? Then he draws a thing about like this. He said, this looks like a mouth. But to the Chinese, that means person. Well, that shouldn't be hard for you Americans to grab. Fella goes to work some morning. Said, my wife gave birth to twins last night. I got two more mouths to feed. Somebody said, you like some overtime? I need overtime, buddy. I've got, you know, six mouths to feed. You ever heard language like that? Well, we use that term mouth to describe a person. He said, what we got here, this means a vessel or a boat with eight people, eight mouth people. What that picture says, once upon a time on this earth, there was a big boat that had eight people in it. I have no doubt, no telling how many millions of times Chinese under the influence of these things I've named later have drawn that off, didn't know what they were drawing. I could give you many, many, many other examples of that. Okay, right fast. God makes the languages of earth a lot more than I'm telling you. I might move fast to get a few more examples. And our way of writing, let me see, I don't want to get this mixed up. You better look this way. In our way of writing, I see, we begin over here at the left and we write, move toward the right. In many, many languages, people begin reading over here on the left and they read to the right. I'll get back to that in just right in a minute. Some languages read left to right, others read right to left. Some languages aren't read that way. Written that way. They're written in columns. Japanese written in columns like this. Right across the narrow peninsula, it's not all that far, we come to Korea. Koreans write in columns, but you read those columns from, let's see, left to right. Okay. Another few little things got to throw in here. Right fast. I feel very, very sorry for people from other countries coming to the United States trying to learn English. You may think they're comical. Way they talk is all right. I feel very sorry for them. English, as Americans speak it, is a hodgepodge. We borrow it a little bit from all kinds of languages, nothing. We use all kinds of figures of speech that don't make sense for another person. I had a plane ride long years ago from Dallas to Memphis beside one of the most fascinating, interesting people I ever met. There's a tiny Japanese man sat beside me, fully dressed. name is Dr. Edwin Kajihiro. He was on his way to lecture some doctors in Tennessee. Dr. Kajihiro, born in Japan, lived a while in Hawaii, educated here in the United States of America, began to tell me about some of his early experiences. I'll leave out some of them. In the old Bible I was carrying with me back then, I don't carry it anymore, too big, too heavy, an old Bible scaring back there, and I got Dr. Kajihiro to write his name for me in English and also in Japanese. The Japanese is written in columns. He was telling me back in his days in America, he goes to do an hospital work. He goes up to a hospital one night to check on a patient. Tiny little Japanese fellow like this. He said he was immediately met by this very crude, very rough head nurse. He says to her, "How is my patient, Mr. So-and-so, doing?" She looks down at him and said, "Your patient is about ready to kick the bucket." He said, "Oh, hooray, wonderful, wonderful." Because he said in Japan, anybody who feels like kicking a bucket around feels pretty well. Last time I saw him, he was in no shape to kick a bucket. That's what he thinks. He said, "Hooray, hooray." She looks down, "Are you crazy or something?" That didn't make any sense to him. Expressions like "it is raining cats and dogs," you couldn't translate that into Japanese, Filipino, a whole lot of other languages. Some people do not use our old silly figures of speech. I feel sorry for them when they come over here. Americans drive on a parkway to park in a driveway. Americans sometimes say exactly the opposite of what they mean. Your children or grandchildren act ugly. You say, "Well, aren't you, isn't that cute?" Meaning ugly. "Aren't you smart?" Meaning dumb. Sometimes we say the exact opposite. So, I've just scratched the surface of what I'm talking about. There's a Russian one time told of his experience in coming to America. He kind of learned English, but he hadn't learned American. Learned to read English. He reads this advertisement, big sale last week. He said, "Why they advertised it? I already missed it." It wasn't punctuated. The way we read that is, "Big sale last week." He didn't know all that. Big sale last week. Why'd they advertise it? I done missed it. A lot of things written here in America, you have to know, you know, when to breathe, when to pause. I was taking a ride down East Texas years ago. The elder W.B. Stanley and Brother Burness's daddy, one of the most interesting, charming people I ever knew. Old Brother Stanley over there driving me over here riding. We came to a place up here where the road was blocked, construction. Brother Stanley said, "Elder Piles, there's a sign there that says it has three words and no punctuation mark. How do you read that sign?" I said, "That says to be slow, men working." "Not to me. It says slow men working." I can give you a third way I have a reading of. Slow men working. You got that? Now, this Russian, he didn't know when to pause and when to breathe. Big sale last week. Why did they advertise it? I done missed it. I have a lot more patience than a lot of folk they used to have. Now then, I got to wind this up somewhere. I'm going to wind this somewhere, and I'm going to go to an unusual place to wind it up. We come over to the day of Pentecost, Acts chapter 2. And I'm going to refer to the day of Pentecost in some ways as Babel in reverse. On the day of Pentecost, you're going to find that the Bible tells us here, because of the feast of Pentecost, there's Jews and proselytes have come in from many parts of the world, all over the Roman Empire, many parts of the world. Because everywhere they felt this obligation to return to Jerusalem for this big pilgrimage. Says they were gathered together devout men, Jews, out of every nation under heaven. But these Jews have picked up many dialects. They picked up many languages, all kinds of dialects and languages. They're gathered together. You read that list, it'll list at least 17 nations I could remember. This lists these nations. and they might have all been Jews. Well, they weren't. Some of them proselytes. That means converts. But they had dialects. So you find here you have at least 17 nations, languages, dialects, and all this gathered together. The power of the Holy Spirit came upon those apostles, and the Bible says they began to speak to these people, and those people out there were dumbfounded. They said, "Are not all these men Galileans?" Which I tell you something else. These preachers here, they were not language scholars. They were, most of them as far as worldly languages, education concerned. They were ignorant and unlearned men. Didn't mean they were men of low intelligence. It just meant they didn't have a lot of schooling, didn't have schooling. And next, they spoke with the Galilean brogue, which I don't have time to explain that. You get in another part of Israel and they've got different dialects. These people here are amazed. Are not all these men Galileans? How is it we hear in our own tongue wherein we were born the wonderful works of God? These men filled with the Holy Ghost are speaking in one language, the Galilean dialect. Here's people out here with all these languages and dialects, and every one of them's hearing and understanding. Remember in Babel, they had one language. God sticks his finger in the matter, they lined up with many. Here on the day of Pentecost, there's people all kinds of dialects. God puts his finger in it. You have men up here preaching in one language. They're out there, every one of them, hearing in their own language wherein they were born, the wonderful works of God. Somebody say, well, does anything like that ever happen today? Not exactly like that, but I want to give you, I want to give you an example of a spiritual way it does happen, and I'll just use this very building right here. I could give you many examples, but I want to give you one. I have very, very clear memories. Times back in the 70s and 80s, being in this very pulpit, with folk packed in here like hay in a baler, I have very clear memories of Elder Darty getting up with his 500-watt smile about two or three times during a song service and urging people to do this. Sometimes people say we had a house full, loose all over the building. Type of house full some of you folk remember, Brother Darty, you know, couldn't you? I've been up here, people out here packed everywhere like hay in a baler. On one of those occasions, I was in the pulpit out here, sort of looking at folk. Right there sat Dr. Wayne Fairclough, Ph.D., one of the dearest friends I ever had on this earth. And I'll tell you a lot about Brother Fairclough. He wouldn't say about himself. He's gone from this world right now. He's a very humble Primitive Baptist deacon. He was also one of the most brilliant men I ever met in his field. He was a dean of botany and biology down at Valdosta U. I've been to his office, been down there many times. They had a massive plant library. I could talk to you about that a long time. Brother Fairclough, was also the most capable church historian I knew during that day and time among the Primitive Baptists. Here's one of the most super brilliant people I knew. I could name you places such as Eureka where I would preach, and he would leave there and go to Atlanta or somewhere else to lecture a gathering of professors. He was a professor's professor. I've told you a lot of things about him. He's too humble to tell you about himself. So there sits one of the most brilliant humans I was ever around, right there. Right on that bench over there were some children, 5 to 7 years of age, some of them whose feet, I don't think, quite touched the floor. I found out Elder Dart had announced there were maybe 23, 24 preachers here. So we have out there mamas, housewives, some people never been in a Primitive Baptist church before. So what I'm trying to describe to you, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, a preacher, a Primitive Baptist preacher, has got a job like no other kind of teacher on the face of the earth. I've got something on my mind, and I'm begging God to help me deliver it in such a way that a man of like Brother Faircloth, can get some spiritual food and points out of it. And this preacher's here of varying experience and ability, and I hope I can preach this up in such a way that they'll grab some things to stimulate them, but I've got to consider these youngsters. I've also got to consider the folk out here maybe never been to Primitive Baptist building before. People out here of all phases, stages, or many stages of age and development. I faced that here more than once. I faced that in many places. But I'm going to tell you what's happened to me when the Lord is with me. This is something I cannot turn on and off. I cannot bring it down myself. I cannot produce it. I've been in many places like that. And if the Lord blessed me to preach, a man of Brother Faircloth, I'm up here obviously talking in one language. Man of Brother Faircloth, spiritually speaking, could hear it in his language. Children here are translating it into their language. Folks out here, housewives, people of various languages, are translating it into their words. And what I'm saying is here, the things I say are the things any other preacher says. Don't have their greatest effect if you just remember them in my words. They have the greatest effect when you're blessed to be able to put that in your words and apply it to your experience. I hope I'm making this halfway clear. When we go a place today, and we've got all kinds of people here. Children out here thinking their language. Folk out here thinking based on their, you know, educational level, experience of life, you're thinking in your language. But if God blesses the service, people on all these levels, spiritually, go away and they have heard something in their language. So, I realize I've only scratched the surface of what I'm trying to tell you, or getting across to you today. But you're intelligent people. Think this out, search this out yourselves. But there'll be one day that God's people out of every kindred tongue, people, and nation in heaven will be in heaven, and in one language will praise Him. Revelation 5, for thou art worthy, for thou wast slain, and hast redeemed us to God by every kindred and tongue and people and nation on the earth. I think if you're very, very good attention, and I'm not paying all that much attention to the clock. Like I say, I'm a little mixed up, but I like it though. Start 11:30. I'm paying attention to something else. I'm quitting for another reason. Something else tells me to quit. I'm getting hungry. Somebody says, you mean hungry? No, my Blue Ridge Mountain friends say hungry. And that's a stage beyond hungry. And I expect the chiller babies out here and the children, which have been very, very good, very quiet. I'm expecting them right soon start sounding off, giving me their signals it's time to quit. God bless you and keep you. And come ahead, Brother Pastor, if you will.